This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's Natchez in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, nothing going on. There's always something cooking, nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China, so finish what you got.
To be nation, welcome to the unseasonably warm, luscious, luxurious studios of the hard traveling fanboys in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, my companion, my compadre, Mr. Nick Duke. Nick, how are you on this undetermined night?
I'm doing very well. I'm sitting right here in my in my subsection of the British Columbian studios, and I've got Herschel the Wonder Dog sitting right next to me, so all is well.
You can't beat that. Have you run across any PED-using insects lately?
No PED-using insects, but I do have a PED-using smoke alarm that may or may not play a role tonight.
Oh, interesting. I'm getting word from the back. Hold on. Folks, we got a special guest with us here. Hold on, what's this? Hang on. People over there, oh yeah! If you feel me, stand up and say, oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! You better come get with this! Oh yeah! Or you can get with that! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah,
ladies and gentlemen,
skipping and jumping and leaving the competition, making them disappear like your favorite by God magician. I ride that till the wheels fall off. Oh yeah,
ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, J.R. Truth.
And I want to thank you for listening to the show this week, and you can catch me in all my glory every week on the Ross Report.
Well, moving on after that surprise run-in, should we start the show proper? We have a litany of things to discuss because our watching schedules have both filled out.
That's right. Our watching schedules have filled out like the Jodie Sweetin from Full House. And
Now I don't know if they filled out quite that well, but it's neither here nor there.
But let's get into it. And kick it off with a little segment that we like to call
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Oh, and with that, what better to set the mood for what's to come? As usual, we're going to kick it off with our top three books and our bottom one. And where should we start this week, Nick?
Well, last week we started at the bottom, so why don't we start at the top this time?
Started at the top, and now we're where we are in our lives. I'll get us cracking here with my number three book of the time period, and it's a shocker, folks. It's an upset special because it comes out of left field, not even on my pull list. I bought it off the shelf on a recommendation from people who shall be named later that may share this show with me. Batman number 9 by Tom King, Mikael Janin. This kicks off the I Am Suicide story arc, as Nick mentioned last week, which is a is kind of billed as a reinvention of a classic Batman villain of Bane, but it seems thus far to be less a reinvention of Bane and more just a modernization of Bane, and works to perfection. This is the best that Bane has been written, that I've read anyway, since Gail Simone had him in Suicide Squad. In Secret Six. And this is more the classic Denny O'Neill, Chuck Dixon Bane from Vengeance of Bane, if anyone here has read that or read that when they were a kid, maybe. You get to see in these opening pages Bane in the prison in Santa Prisca as a youngster, as a 4-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a 14-year-old, and as a 21-year-old. And you get an idea of what makes him Batman's equal in so many ways, because while Batman's torture was primarily psychological, Bane's torture that he experienced as a child was physical in nature and psychological in nature. And you can see why he has become Batman's, arguably his most deep. And I also wanted to point out that the art, particularly in the first three pages where you're seeing the flashbacks of Bane growing up in the prison and getting flooded every night, it reminds me of Tales of the Black Freighter from Watchmen. If anyone remembers that comic within a comic, the art style here, very Dave Gibbons-esque, very, muted colors. The colors are really what put it over the top. And that's been kind of a recurring theme in this Batman comic. I thought the colors have been just off the charts great from pretty much beginning to end on this Tom King run. Even though the stories have not always worked for me, I thought this was the best issue yet in Tom King's run, and so I am back on board. I am back on board. I'm excited about what's to come. Artwork remains phenomenal. The Suicide Squad put together by Batman is a really cool concept that I don't know has been done before. Maybe it has. But
I guess the outsiders would be close to that. I mean,
true.
Not quite to that level. Not villains out and out, but you know, certainly a ragtag bunch that Batman put together back in the 80s.
Indeed.
Or the 70s, I forget.
Who can keep track anymore?
We'll have to ask Todd Weber next time we talk to
him. Todd and Kelly can fill us in on that. The colors are by June Chung, by the way. I wanted to give her a special shout-out because she's outstanding on this book, assuming it's a she. With a name like June, I would assume. So, anyway, Batman number 9, my pick. I know you liked it as well, Nick.
I did. I talked about it last week's show, so yep. Nothing really to add there. Moving on to my number 3 book of the week, I've got Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 7. This is the big throwdown between Hal and Sinestro. This manages to not feel like it's retreading old ground for the umpteenth time. This actually manages to bring something a little bit new to the battle, and I really, really enjoyed it. And that's essentially what the issue is one long, protracted fight between Hal and Sinestro. I mean, you have some side stuff going on, a few good scenes with Guy Gardner, some good stuff with Soren Ignatiu, with her making some decisions that actually feel in character for her for the first time in a while. So, you know, I continue to be very, very impressed by this Green Lantern Corps book. And I would say at this point, judging them both by, you know, as the totality of their respective series, this has been the superior Green Lantern book, in my opinion. So Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 7 takes home my number 3 spot.
I am still remarkably behind on that book due to one missing issue that is preventing me from reading all the rest of them that I've got in my stash. But I'm looking forward to it for sure. I've heard nothing but good things about this. And what a turnaround, huh, for Robert Venditti, turning
Absolutely.
Into a damn good Green Lantern writer. On to my number 2, which is – I feel like this book pops up every month on my – or every few weeks on my list, and that's Deathstroke number 4 by Christopher Priest and Joe Bennett. This is continuing the story of – who put out the hit on Slade's daughter, Rose, the Ravager. Somebody has put out a hit on her life. He goes to Gotham City. He's traced to Gotham. And you know what that means when you go into Gotham City? You got to deal with the Bat. And so this issue introduces a conflict between Slade and Rose against Bruce and Damian. And it's awesome. It is so good, so well written. The dialogue in this book is probably some of the best you'll find in DC Comics. Really, really good stuff. The relationship between Slade and Rose is complicated, to say the least. And they do a great job. Christopher Priest does a great job of capturing a teenager's voice with Rose, and also capturing Wintergreen's voice as kind of the voice of reason for both Slade and Rose. There's also a nice flashback to Rose's training with Dick Grayson here. Just an outstanding book, well-written Damian, who's super arrogant and whose arrogance actually backfires on him in this book. And then a great bit of instead of doing an interior monologue, this book doesn't do that. This has kind of other characters commenting on other – almost a second-person narration sometimes. And there's this little like prose section that's written by Wintergreen where he's describing how Slade views Batman. And it taught, and there's actually a line where it says, Slade often thought Batman would make a great assassin. He admired the work Batman did and hoped he wouldn't have to kill him. So really good stuff here. Highly recommended.
Now let me ask you this. During the flashback sequences with Rose, is she a faded Rose from days gone by?
Oh, no. That's actually going to be found in the new IDW book, Delta Dawn number 1, by Steve Austin and Rob Liefeld.
Oh, sign me up for that one. Will it have an audio accompaniment with it?
It will have an audio accompaniment. Fella that plays a guitar.
And what might that sound like?
Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on? Could it be a faded rose from days gone by?
Excellent. Excellent. In any event, speaking of Gotham, my number 2 book of the week is Detective Comics, number 943. This is the first issue of the Victim Syndicate storyline. You know, last week we talked about, or I talked about how much I love the most recent issue of Green Lanterns because it introduced a new villainous concept that was so simplistic, so simple, that it was instantly effective. It was easy to relate to. It was easy to understand. It was easy to sink your teeth into. Same concept here. This is essentially introducing a new villain, a group of villains for Batman, and the concept is simply, you know, one of the tenets of Batman that's always been around is the idea that perhaps Batman's rogues gallery exists, you know, as a direct response to Batman's existence. And so, would it not stand to reason that Batman could be blamed for a lot of the people who've been put in harm's way? And this is taking that idea and carrying it out. So I really, really like the introduction of these new villains. I also enjoyed the Bruce and Kate Kane dynamic that they're playing up here, and also the usage of Colonel Jacob Kane in his what seems to be his recurring role going forward. I can already tell I'm going to love it. I think you will, too, once you get there, and you will see the parallels it draws to a certain other character that we love from pop culture. So Batman Active Comics 943 continues to just be an outstanding read and the best Batman comic on the shelf right now.
I'm assuming that character from pop culture is going to be the Demon Kane.
Of course. Absolutely. But also Corporate Kane. He'll be playing two, both roles.
Two different characters.
Yep.
Demon Kane is what my father watched. Anyway.
Complete with coffee mug, strangely enough.
Yes. My number one of the week, you mentioned it in your review of Detective Comics, actually. It is Green Lantern's number 9, part 1 of the Phantom Lantern. This is a book you mentioned a little bit last week. I believe it made your top 3. And
it did.
It was number 1 with a bullet for me. This was outstanding. As much as I've enjoyed Green Lanterns, and I have enjoyed most of the issues of Green Lanterns quite a bit, this to me was the best issue. This felt, and this is the first time I could truly say this about any Green Lantern book in about 3 years, even the excellent Hal Jordan, the Green Lantern Corps books, this felt like Geoff Johns wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
It is taking an obscure character from early in Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run and completely reinventing him and turning him into what feels like the first new great Green Lantern villain, gosh, since I don't know, since when? I don't even know. But
Atrocitus was essentially a... I mean, he had been around before, but
well,
the Johns
yeah, no,
was the guy who
but, kind of... But, you know, that's still been, you know, many years now.
Right. I mean, so, less than 10 years, though.
True. But it's been a long time. I mean, it's been... There's been many attempts. This ain't no relic, I'll put it that way.
No.
this is giving you a villain that you instantly have a reason to empathize with in, on some level. Not maybe not empathize with, but sympathize with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can understand what his motivations are, even if you don't agree with those motivations.
Right.
And that's the linchpin for a great comic book villain. They really dig into his psyche here, what makes him tick. You definitely see what makes him villainous because he's driven by greed. He's driven by selfishness. Mm-hmm. But he's also not a mustache twirler either, you know? It's a great job by Sam Humphries and Robson Rocha of creating this new compelling character that it was really almost inspiring. I mean, we talked about it offline a little bit, Nick, about how this is a pretty straightforward and not complicated way to introduce a new villain, and it just works.
Absolutely. And like you said, I mean, you don't necessarily empathize with him, but you do sympathize. And you can even see to a certain extent how, to begin with, you know, this person, this new villain, may have been a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see, like, slowly them reaching their breaking point and, you know, their frustration and their confusion over the way the world has worked. Mm-hmm. And I would actually say that the moment they make their decision to become a villain is actually genuinely heartbreaking because everything they want is right in front of them and it's taken away at the last possible second. So
also, I think you and I both appreciated his assessment of as he watched Kyle Rayner get a Green Lantern ring instead of him, and he says, "Suddenly there was a fourth Green Lantern. He didn't look like much to me."
And he wasn't. But that's another topic for another time.
On to your number one, sir.
My number one book of the week, which seems to find itself here every other week, just about. I'm going with Wonder Woman number 9. This is another Greg Rucka and Liam Sharp issue. We have moved on from the lies, and now we have begun seeking the truth. And this issue is mostly what seems to be a prologue to the actual main story. It's Diana and Barbara Ann back together, hanging out with Argus, trying, you know, just kind of trying to piece their lives together for the moment. And you get some hints of, you know, people pulling the strings behind the scenes that have, you know, cruel intents for our hero and everything. But for the most part, this is just focused on Diana trying to help Barbara Ann reaccommodate to normal life. I mean, strangely enough, them going clothes shopping together is one of the best scenes in the book, which sounds boring, but it actually, you know, Rucka used it to make a really cool point about what Diana means to the larger populace. And then also, we've talked about Rebirth, how one of the things that has been added back into the DC universe as a concept is that concept of romance and love and some of the class relationships. You know, I was really happy to see things like Green Arrow and Black Canary back. But I've never been one who's had a huge attachment to the Steve, Trevor, and Diana relationship. That may have all changed here with one scene, because I think in one scene in this book, Greg Rucka made me a fan of this dynamic and this relationship between these two characters, and I absolutely loved it. It might be my favorite scene in this book in the series thus far. It was outstanding how well it was done, illustrating to you how difficult it is for Diana to truly connect with people and how Steve is still special to her after all these years. And it's kind of weird. They give it a little humorous slant, you know, getting to see Steve Trevor, who is absolutely a mortal man, interact with somebody that, you know, the rest of the world considers to be a god, essentially. So I absolutely love this book. Liam Sharp, I think, is quickly becoming the definitive Wonder Woman artist, for me anyway. So Wonder Woman number 9, you know, can't say enough good things about it. Looking forward to you getting all caught up on this one.
I'm pretty close, actually. I'm very close. I'm two issues behind, I believe. So I'm getting close on that one. That's one that I read every time. I read them in order as I pick them up. So you mentioned Cruel Intentions, good movie, boy, enjoyable movie. I was going to ask you this question since Wonder Woman pops up so often on your list. You kind of like me, but even more so than me, had never read much, if any, Wonder Woman before Rebirth. How quickly has this shot her up your list of favorite DC characters?
Pretty quickly. You know, the trick is going to be, I think, me expanding my Wonder Woman knowledge and finding out if it's truly a love of Wonder Woman or if it's a love of Greg Rucka's Wonder Woman. You know, because a similar thing happened with Geoff Johns' Aquaman. I tried to go back and read some, you know, 70s and 80s Aquaman and stuff, and I will say that I was not overly enthused by it. But, I mean, you know, you never know if you're going to have that same response or not. So we will we'll see how that goes going forward.
Right. I also am – if only there was a way that someone could go through digitally and read the back catalog of Wonder Woman comics. Wouldn't that be impressive, Nick?
It would be quite impressive, especially if there are any, you know, recent iconic runs that, you know, people that were heavily, heavily praised critically. You know, the Brian Azzarello run. If there was an easy way for us to get our hands on that and – some sort of digital form where we can just read it at our leisure. But unfortunately there isn't. So we'll just,
unfortunately the technology just doesn't exist yet.
The technology just isn't out there. It just ain't around.
That's right. Well, let's move on to our quick hit segment. We're going to ping pong back and forth until probably Nick will take over for the majority of this, 'cause I only have three, but,
you go right ahead.
I'm going to kick us off with Green Lanterns number 8. Fun issue, nothing spectacular, but a good little issue where they go treating Simon and Jessica with the kids. The Dominators show up. There's a brouhaha. Fun little comic book.
Absolutely. Hey, are we still doing our bottom book of the week, by the way?
Yes, but let's do our quick hits first.
All right, fair enough. And I'll take two at a time since you only have three. Civil War II, number 6. After a very good issue of Civil War II in Civil War II number 5, this is back closer to mediocrity, yet still better than the initial four issues. It was just kind of okay. Same thing can be said for Star Wars 24. I still continue to enjoy this series overall, but I do know that the series tends to dip a little bit for me when it's focusing more on just your normal Stormtrooper threat, which this kind of seems to be. I'm ready for some more outlandish, unique concepts that we haven't seen in the movies before.
You're so ready for some unique situations.
Indeed.
Okay, I'm gonna have one other quick hit before I get to my bottom. My other quick hit, Wonder Woman number 7, excellent. Came very close to making my number 3 spot. Everything that you said about the series is true. It's just consistently great. I don't think there's been a bad issue in the whole batch, and this is another great one. So, hats off.
Teen Titans number 1 picks right up where the Rebirth special left off. Still a very good book. It's still very much, you know, in the setup period, so not much meat here, but at least Ben Percy seems to have a handle on how to write these characters in a comedic fashion, so enjoyed this one. The Wonder Woman 75th Anniversary Special. I best summed up as a collection of Wonder Woman short stories by some really talented writers and artists, and also a book that Greg Phillips would never buy because it has a $7.99 cover price. Action Comics 966, wrapping up the Lois Lane Back at the Planet storyline. This is essentially one long conversation between Clark, Lois, and Lana Lang, a.k.a. Superwoman, and it kind of sets up Lois Lane's new status quo. I am looking forward to this book getting back to being an action comic, however. Titans number 4. Enjoyed this one. However, I will say, like you, Greg, this is the first time that the Booth art actually bothered me a little bit. So, solid writing, but not crazy about the art here.
Very good, Mr. Lau. And let us move on. My least favorite part of the week, our bottom book of the time period, and again, another week where there wasn't really a bad comic book in the batch, but there's one that I thought was clearly worse than the rest for me, and it would be the aforementioned Titans number 4 by Dan Abnett and Booth. I pretty much agree with everything you said. The writing, very good. The story is excellent, but the story and the writing are the only reason I'm still pulling this book. I love the team. I love Wally West. I love Linda Park. I love Wally and Linda together. I'm invested in this story. The writing has been great for the team. The art just doesn't do it for me. And again, I'm not going to bash an artist severely most of the time because I can do what they do. But just for subjective taste, Brett Booth's art just doesn't do it for me at all. Like, his faces don't seem effective to me. They don't seem right sometimes, even tonally. The weird contorted bodies in some scenes are strange. The positioning of people in different scenes is strange. It almost feels outdated. It almost feels like the worst Spider-Man art of the 90s to me. Like the Spider-Man art that would turn me off, where you've got really over-exaggerated facial expressions, really over-exaggerated body contortions and things like that, while still trying to marry yourself to sort of a house style. And just isn't working for me artistically. But the story remains good.
Well, you want to talk about books that don't work artistically. I'm going to give you my bottom book of the week. And this, by a wide margin, was The Flash, number 9. You know, Flash has been off my pull list for a while, but the solicit for this one promised, a little bit more of a heavier tie to the Rebirth special, kind of picking up back some threads, you know, from a couple months ago. And while, you know, there was a little bit of that, I would argue the solicit oversold it. Not that a solicit's ever done that before. This almost made me put it down because of the art. I thought it was atrocious. Jorge Corona, perhaps George Corona. I don't know the pronunciation, but nor do I care. Yeah, you're right. You want to talk about faces that look unrealistic. Dude, the faces all look like they're modeled after that famous painting, The Scream, where every time a person opens their mouth like bends like three different ways. The hair on every character is just out in the open everywhere. Barry Allen looks not unlike Dennis Quaid in Great Balls of Fire as Jerry Lee Lewis. It's atrocious.
I'm going to hell playing the piano.
Exactly. It's the worst drawn books I've seen, especially from a guy who apparently is one of the regular featured artists on Flash. So avoid this at all costs. Avoid it the plague. If this guy is going to be drawing this book, this pretty much sold me on not buying any more Flash.
Now, here's the big question.
For the remainder of his run.
Where does this guy how does this guy compare to that feller that drew drew Thor for that little brief
Oh, not anywhere as bad as that guy, but still pretty bad.
Yeah, I would agree. I read the preview pages from this one, and it was enough to turn me off artistically, although I think I might have bought it anyway just to read the story because I was interested in the meaning of the Wallys. But artistically, not really doing much to get me to pick it back up. But anyway, that'll wrap up our reading segment. I have recently purchased, if you will, and you will because I'm forcing you to, a stack of comic books to try and catch up. And I'm making decent headway on it, although I'm also reading our next Long Book Hunters venture, which you can catch in a couple weeks, that being The Punisher, Welcome Back, Frank. And that'll be good. But let's move on to what you're watching. And boy, are we watching a lot of stuff right now, Nick.
Woo. We're full up.
That's right. It's hard for the hard-traveling fanboys to keep up, which is not an uncommon problem for us. But I guess we've got the CW shows and we've got The Walking Dead. So where do you want to begin?
As we usually do, let's take them in order and let's start with Supergirl, which we
wouldn't it be? Oh no, you're right. Yep.
Yeah, Supergirl, which we've been running a week behind on because you're not watching it each week before the show. So
right.
let's take last week's Supergirl first.
Yes, last week's Supergirl, which spoiler alert. It's a spoiler alert, people. I'm going to say this very quickly, and then we'll get past it. Spoiler alert, introduced Miss Martian at the very end of the episode.
Yes, that was the closing shot of the episode, so not at all the main thrust of the episode. But still an interesting way to see, you know, Miss Martian brought in, and something we knew was coming based on casting announcements, but still pretty cool.
Right,
to see,
and I would argue, I would argue it was very well executed because I actually didn't see it coming. Like I was caught off guard by how they did it. I thought that was really, really cool. Didn't see her being the bartender at the end. Really good twists to the episode, which was a good episode again overall. I enjoyed the episode. Yeah. It was more strong writing of Kara's character. Mm-hmm. More strong writing of Alex in particular. I thought this was a really strong episode for her. Introduced the DC version of Maggie Sawyer, returned Lena Luthor to the screen, and also
brought in Linda Carter.
Linda Carter as the president, which is a really cool, including a really cool wink and nod line where she was talking about Kara was complimenting her on the Air Force One, and she said, "You should see my other jet." And you know, that was a pretty cute little line there. I enjoyed that.
And it had a cool dynamic where it was clear that Kara was a complete fangirl for the president, so that was kind of
cool. It was just another good episode. This is, you know, really a feel good show in general. So excellent stuff.
And it really sets up, you know, what I think is going to be a really emotionally heavy and a storyline that you can really get interested in the Maggie Sawyer and Alex Danvers dynamic that they seem to be exploring in some way.
Are you suggesting that there may have been some sort of sparks perhaps between
the
two law enforcement characters?
Interesting is the way I would put it. Interesting.
Compelling television, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be good. Also, thought Henshaw had some of the best lines of this episode. He was hit particularly his reaction to Kara worrying over what to wear when the president arrives was particularly outstanding, I felt. So that was a good episode.
Absolutely. So let's move on to The Flash, which had a hell of an episode. Wow. So Greg, tell the people a little bit about The Flash for just a minute.
The Flash was what can I say about this episode? This was just everything that I love about The Flash wrapped up in one episode. Terrific pace to this episode. The pacing was unparalleled. The dynamics between the cast, whether it be Joe, Barry together, Iris and Barry together, Iris and Joe together, or Harrison Wells and anyone. This episode gave us all the Harrison Wellses. Actually, it didn't give us all the Harrison Wellses. It gave us enough Harrison Wellses to whet my appetite for even more. I could have watched 30 minutes of nothing but alternate Harrison Wellses from different dimensions and universes coming in and pitching themselves to the team. We got cowboy Harrison Wells. We got British
Harrison
Wells.
Yeah, and I'm a little disappointed that we didn't just get cowboy Harrison Wells, the Harrison Wells going forward. Honestly, of all the Harrison Wells we got, I thought they picked the worst one.
They did. No question they picked the worst one. I would have 100% – I mean, British Harrison Wells was fine. But come on, cowboy Harrison Wells – would be the best. I mean, instantly would be the best character on DC television if they had brought him in. Just phenomenal. This was,
and he played such an over the top version of a cowboy that it's almost like David Sunday's cowboy Joker.
Yes,
like, that's really what it sounds like.
I described it like that to someone actually the other day. I said it reminded me of the Southern Joker from David, and it really did. It was remarkable. This episode finally gave Tom Cavanaugh a chance to really show people how funny he is, because he was on a show called Ed back in the early 2000s that is one of the most unheralded, awesome comedies of all time, in my opinion. Loved that show, and he was the star of it, and he was awesome. And so it was great to get to see him flex his comedic muscles on this one. He's great in every scene anyway. But he was so good as these comedy characters, his interactions with the rest of the team, when he beats Cisco to naming the Mirror Mask Master, which was an awesome moment, including Cisco coming back at him later in the episode, which is further evidence that we never need to see emo Cisco ever again. And just.
But we do need to see billionaire Ric Flair.
Right. We need billionaire Cisco and Cowboy Wells in a team up.
Oh, going on adventures.
That's
together.
Right. They actually probably would have been a tag team in the 80s NWA. So the
speaking of Ric Flair, can I make an inappropriate joke that I thought of earlier today?
Sure, go ahead.
So if Ric Flair is Space Mountain, does that make Charlotte Flair Space Valley?
Oh, who else but Nick? Oh, fabulous, fabulous. Anyway, but no, this episode was, I thought, was excellent. Everything about it. The Mirror Master. I haven't even got a chance to talk about the Mirror Master yet. My favorite of the Flash Rogues. Not because of personality, because that would be Captain Cold, but just in terms of his gimmick, his power set, his gun that he uses in the comics or whatever. Mirror Master is the coolest freaking villain. Like, he's...
And I actually thought this was a cooler use of his powers than they typically do in the comics. Agreed. I thought the idea of just, you know, absorbing himself into the mirrors and using the mirrors as portals and that kind of thing was cooler than the gun, which has always been a little... Too many guns running around in the Flash in the Rogues for my taste, but, you know.
Yeah, this is a version of Mirror Master they've done before in the comics, but... Traditionally more with, I believe, with Evan McCullough, the second Mirror Master, who was in the Geoff Johns Flash years, which was a typical Johns awesome creation. But this was incredible. The usage of Mirror Master's powers, in my opinion, one of the best action sequences in the history of the Flash TV show was Barry and Jesse Quick chasing Mirror Master and the Top through these portals, through these mirrors. It reminded me of the video game Portal, if you've ever seen that or played it. It was really, really cool. Can't wait for the Mirror Master to pop up again. Again, to me, the coolest of the Rogues, and definitely excited to see where this goes in the future.
Yeah, I completely agreed. I love the episode. I thought they did a good job with pretty much everything that was going on. It even had the cool... Was this not the episode with the subplot about Joe getting weirded out over public displays of affection?
Yep.
Yeah, I enjoyed that as well. That was really – that had some great comedic value here.
With the money line of, damn, you grown. Very good.
Oh, man. Yeah, Joe continues to be a scene stealer most every week.
Yep.
So, you know, loved that. So moving on to Arrow, which I thought had an – in my opinion – the best episode of its season thus far.
Yeah, go on. You can go first this time.
That's fine. You've talked before about a back-to-basics approach for the show, and I agree that they have attempted that over the first few episodes and largely been successful, but no episode in the season, to me anyway, has felt more like early season one or season two episode than this one. This one was almost entirely focused on Oliver and Diggle. You had some other stuff with some of the side characters. You had Felicity foolishly sending the team to get their asses handed to them in a completely brutal fashion by Oliver, which they all deserve, by the way. So it was awesome. I mean, just everything about this episode was great. The Diggle and Oliver dynamic, I'm so glad to see that it's back. It feels to me like it could be the one thing that will balance out some of the less interesting Wild Dog aspects of the episode. So hopefully more Diggle, less Wild Dog, and hopefully Diggle will be there to serve as a balance between Oliver and Felicity and get her to stop, you know, disagreeing with everything Oliver says just as soon as it comes out of his mouth.
Right, I thought this episode was excellent as well. This was a great episode pretty much from beginning to end, complete with – although, you know, Wild Dog continues to be a frustrating character who needs to die. But, you know, given that he blatantly disobeys Oliver at the beginning of the episode and not only disobeys Oliver but misses every shot he takes in the process, which begs the question, what purpose does he serve? He gets his ass kicked every time he fights someone. He can't hit a shot. He's annoying. He needs to get beaten to death by Tobias Church. And thankfully, at the end of this episode, they did give us scenes of Tobias Church beating the bejesus out of the kid.
Yes, which means they're not actually going to follow through on his death, unfortunately.
But we did get a pretty awesome performance from I'm just going to call him Tyrese, we got a pretty awesome performance from Tyrese.
Now, wait just a minute. You can call him Tyrese, but I can't call Derek Wallace Derek Wallace.
Quite frankly, more people remember Tyrese than they remembered the kicker from The Waterboy.
I'll have you know, the kicker from The Waterboy was essential to that plot.
He wasn't even essential to the plot. Now, hold on. Let's take a divergence right now in the middle of our talking about Arrow, and let's briefly talk about The Waterboy, the 1998 Adam Sandler film, The Waterboy.
Let's.
You could have put... You're telling me that the kicker was as memorable as the Cajun coach.
Did I say memorable or did I say essential, Greg?
You could have had any of the other characters play the same.
He was Bobby Boucher's first and only friend for quite some time. You must remember that. He was Bobby's foray into a new world. And he provided him with his single helmet, which was essential because you had a multi-million dollar movie star in Adam Sandler who needed to be able to show his face during football scenes. So you had to have some sort of plot device worked up for that.
But the only new horizons that mattered to Bobby Boucher were when Vicky Valancourt showed him her boobies and he liked them.
And he liked them too. That's a good point.
But
you will also remember it gave us the memorable Derek Wallace kicking the Ku Klux Klan head through the goalpost.
Yes, it did. Let's put it off funny. And paint The Waterboy.
I'm fine with it. We could probably tie it into the WCW comic somehow, what with the appearances of Captain Insano.
Absolutely. But no, speaking of things that we like, Arrow. We liked Arrow. And
we did.
Yeah, Diggle, phenomenal. An emotional, awesome subplot that really tugged on the heartstrings when Diggle gets back to Star City and he tells Oliver, "You said that you've never changed. Well, don't." Awesome and refreshing and cool. And also, special mention to the flashbacks, which continue to be incredible. Anatoly is a great character. You are sarcasm, yes? Very good. Yes. He's awesome. I loved how the scene with Oliver and the guy in the jail paralleled the scene of Adrian Chase interrogating the thug at the jail in Star City. Because it left you with the question of how far was Chase going to go if he hadn't been interrupted by Tobias Church. They're really playing this thread of like, what is Chase really hiding monster underneath? You know, it's like it continues that Bruce Wayne, Harvey Dent.
Some have theorized that Chase might be Prometheus.
Ooh, I honestly hadn't considered that possibility, but that's a possibility for sure. Quite curious, but he's been awesome, I think. I think I mentioned this to you via text message when I was watching the episode, that the guy playing Chase is really impressing me right now.
Yeah, he's really good. I agree. And while, you know, we both love this episode, I want to take a moment here, and I want to give you an opportunity, Greg, because, you know, we have mostly agreed this season of Arrow has been excellent thus far, but our main point of disagreement has been that of Felicity.
Right.
So right now, I want you to defend your girl about her choices in this episode.
Now, wait a minute. My girl, you've been just as big a fan of Felicity as I have since...
I haven't been defending her for the last three episodes every time she disagrees with Oliver, which I will remind you is virtually every time Oliver does anything.
Well, quite frankly, it's not for me to say.
That's slang for you actually don't agree with Felicity in this situation.
I actually didn't agree with Felicity in this episode. I thought she was 100% in the wrong in everything that she did in this episode and was proven as such at the end when Diggle comes to realize, hey, it actually was a good idea to break me out of prison. Diggle himself acknowledged it, and she didn't acknowledge it.
And not just that, but he tells Oliver, as you said, not to change, which is to say, you're right in everything you do, Oliver, essentially.
I don't know that he means.
That was the subtext there. Just because you didn't get it doesn't mean it wasn't there.
But I will say that's what I meant when I said it was refreshing, is that it was refreshing to see Oliver actually acknowledged for doing good things in the episode, because it feels like it's been a while since Oliver has been recognized for doing anything right.
What do you think the deal is with the writers this season with that Oliver-Felicity dynamic?
I think
it borders on antagonistic at times, which is odd.
It is a little strange. I think there's still just dynamic chemistry every time they're together on screen.
Right, I'm not disagreeing with that.
They have incredible humor between each other and everything. I feel like, I don't know, I think the writers are intentionally trying to distance them through their writing. Like, trying to get it out of people's heads that this is a thing that happened. You know what I mean?
Which is unfortunate.
Which is unfortunate, exactly, because...
I mean, because if you want their romance to end, then you should write a
logical, sensical conclusion to it, which they never gave us. So,
right,
they don't appear willing to give us at this point. But that being
said, I think it's an overcorrection from the people who hated the Elicity thing. I think it's a drastic course change that wasn't.
I have never known any multimedia property affiliated with DC Comics to overcorrect anything. It's never happened.
All right. Well, we spent enough time on Arrow, which I think we both would agree is the episode of the week.
No, I'm going to say Flash was the episode of the week.
Oh,
but
man,
I loved Arrow. The Flash to me is the Flash to me is the best episode of the season of any of the shows so far.
Ooh, probably say Arrow this week was the best episode of any of the.
It's close. They were both great. We haven't talked about Legends yet.
Yeah, let's talk about Legends, which I would argue that Legends, to this point, is the most improved of any of the shows.
It's very...
Well, I guess Arrow, technically, but, I mean, Legends, the first season, you know, we hadn't really... There was no standard of excellence that Arrow is trying to live up to. Legends had good moments in its first season, you know, some great moments, but I think it's consistently great as some of the highs that Arrow has hit during its time.
Of course.
So I would say Legends has just been a drastic improvement from season one, especially if you're comparing the first, you know, three episodes of season two to the first three episodes.
I would agree with that for sure. You know, I was really high on it last season, as you know, but yeah, the first three episodes this season have been tremendous. This one took place in feudal Japan, which is kind of...
is always a cool visual, like, you know, place to visit. For this show that can do pretty much any kind of time period, this was a no-brainer. I've always been a sucker for feudal Japan, ancient Egypt, those kind of time settings that are just awash in, you know, pomp and circumstance and those sorts of things.
And they did a great job of balancing... two or three different subplots in this episode that all kind of worked for me and all kind of tied together. And, you know, from just the little comedic things like Heatwave loving ninja movies from the 80s, which is, of course, speaking to my heart because, you know, I love me some ninja movies from the 80s. Michael Dudikoff for life. And that was really cool to hear him, you know, referencing all these movies and stuff and tropes about ninjas from movies, and the Ray Palmer subplot. He's such a great character, and they did good stuff with him. And they're doing a good job with this new character of Steel. They've really done a good job of establishing him and making him compelling. And
I've also enjoyed the inclusion of the new / old Vixen.
Yeah,
I've enjoyed that
absolutely.
As well.
Completely, and the dynamic with her and Mick Rory Heatwave was really cool too, because it was kind of like her coming to learn what the audience has come to learn about him over the course of the last season or so, which is that underneath all of the bluster, he's not that bad of a guy.
Right.
And for me, the star of the episode was Sarah, as it has been pretty much every week this season. She is just she pops off the screen every time she's on it. And her fight scene at the end was unbelievable. It's a little thing, but I was so impressed that a TV show, much less a CW TV show, pulled off an homage like that. Like it was the scene at the end where she and the samurai guy charge at each other was, I mean, right out of Ninja Gaiden. The opening cinematics of the NES game, Ninja Gaiden, and the scene preceding that, leading up to it, where Sarah is just having this wicked sword fight with all these samurai, unprecedented, easily the best fight scene in the history of Legends, one of the best CW fight scenes, period, I would argue.
Yeah, the great thing about Sarah is they've taken a character who's whose, you know, journey to this point has been mired in tragedy and darkness, and really made her, shockingly, one of the most quote-unquote fun characters in all the DC CW universe. So, I mean, pretty much everything she does now is just a joy watch. So, yeah, I agree with you. Sarah has been one of the best characters on that show to this point.
Totally. So that wraps up the DC CW shows. We mentioned Nick's episode of the week, Arrow, arguably his episode of the season thus far. My episode of the week and episode of the season thus far will be The Flash. So I think we would both agree that the CW shows thus far are escalating in quality each week.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other two shows that you and I aren't as high on as Flash and Arrow, typically, Legends and Supergirl, I think we would both agree, have, to this point, been improvements over their first season.
Certainly.
So, you know, good things all around. But let's move on to episode 2 of The Walking Dead, which we just spent an entire month talking Walking Dead. So, episode 2 of season 7, a drastic departure from episode 1, to put it mildly, I would say.
Yes, episode 1 was, as we mentioned in our award-winning In Our Own Minds podcast last week, focused entirely on answering the question, who did Negan kill? And so the entire episode was built on this tension of someone's going to die, what's going to be the fallout of this death? How violent is it going to get? You have this tension in your body as you're watching the episode. This episode, not much tension at all. This episode was a calm kind of, you know, they came out of the to use certain parlance, folks, they came out of the gates with a hot segment right out the gates, right before the commercial break. Then they slowed it down a little bit, did a heat segment. This was a heat segment, folks. And what this was a slowdown. This was a rear chin lock, but not a boring rear chin lock. This was a rear chin lock that actually leads to something, or seemingly will lead to something. This focused on Morgan and Carol, who we did not see in the premiere episode, as they are being taken care of inside the kingdom, which, full disclosure, when I found out about the concept of the kingdom last year when we saw somebody ride up dressed in a knight's attire with a spear that appeared to be from, the 1700s or so, or actually before that, the 1300s.
Now, to be fair, they don't look like they're from the 1700s. They're wearing more conventional modern-day armor.
Yeah, like, but it still
looked, you know, metal suits and hat, you know, helmets.
It looked
and stuff.
Goofy to me. I was – when that idea was presented to me last season, I haven't read that far in the comics. I laughed out loud when I saw it. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I was like, if this is something they expect me to take seriously on The Walking Dead, this is going to just continue to lose me. That being said, not only did they not expect me to take it seriously, they embraced how silly it was. And that's why I really enjoyed this episode, in addition to another reason that we'll get to in a minute. But this was literally – you get to see Carol – react as the audience should react to this, which is laughing in the face of this guy calling himself King Ezekiel with a pet tiger and talking as if he's a monarch from, Renaissance times and medieval times, at least. And, you know, talking in the Shakespearean dialogue and with the deep, commanding voice. They really played with that, and they had Carol mock it, and they had Morgan kind of say, well, look, we're doing what they're doing seems to be working. Let's stay here for a little bit. Morgan and Carol, two of the best actors on The Walking Dead, I think most would agree with that, and they really got to carry their end of the bargain. Nick, what did you make of The Kingdom, and what did you make of this slowdown episode of The Walking Dead?
Amazingly bizarre is the best way I can put it. From the entire set of Kingdom, where there are people walking around just kind of gleefully smiling at each other in weird ways, to the choir singing an old Johnny Cash tune, which I appreciated. Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. Just a weird place with a weird eccentric leader in King Ezekiel, but I did very much like the reveal that I'm sure we'll touch on in just a second. But I want to throw a shout out to the actor playing
that's what I was going to get to. Yep,
Kari Payton of Young Justice fame. He voiced Aquaman.
Really, I did not know that's who that was.
Yes, he voiced Aqualad on Young Justice, and also, I believe, has voiced Cyborg on various other DC animated. So, the voice work you can tell in this episode where he switches between voices, you can really see his voice chops, you know, on display there.
He was great. That was the other point I was going to hit is he really, really commanded the screen, and it would have taken a lot of actors would have failed in that position. Because it's such an inherently goofy concept on an otherwise serious show. And I gotta say, I thought he absolutely pulled it off and made me care about this character of King Ezekiel.
Absolutely.
In a way that I didn't think that I would.
I'm actually very much looking forward to King Ezekiel sticking around. I'm hoping that eventually we will get the... I'm officially predicting will be the Walking Dead's version of the Mega Power, because we will get, you know, the dynamic force of Dr. Eugene Porter and the unstoppable might of King Ezekiel's right hand man, Jerry, together on screen at the same time.
Ooh. Deuces. Deuces, my friend. And the reveal at the end. I don't want to spoil the reveal for those that haven't watched the episode, but did you like the reveal at the end?
Very much like the reveal. The reveal almost sells the entire episode. I mean, for reasons that, you know, you don't really want to touch on, I don't think.
But, right.
The reveal, I don't think the 50 minutes preceding the reveal work as well without the reveal, if that makes sense. Like, the entire episode swings on that, in my opinion. Because it's one thing to have Carol laugh at it like the audience would, but you've got to redeem it in some way as well. You've got to make people understand why it could actually work and how it actually works. And I bought it when they did that.
Agreed. Also appreciated the slow burn of building up the fact that Negan has encountered these people before and that we are going to see at some point a reckoning between Ezekiel and Negan.
Absolutely. So, yeah, Walking Dead, probably still not as good as episode one, in our opinions, but still a great episode, and I think Walking Dead has bounced back a big way thus far from season six.
Agreed. Well, folks, it's been a long segment. It's really long, but we're not quite ready for a break yet. We're going to go ahead and hit you with a little something called the Rundown.
And this week's will be fairly short, because I mean, I think you would agree, Greg. As far as things go, not an overwhelmingly huge week in the world of comic book news.
No, not in the world of comic bookery. I would tend to agree with you on that. But the news that is here is a little surprising. It doesn't really come from the book side so much as it comes from the movie side. And where do you think we should start out with on this one, Nick? I'll start us off. We talked last week about Deadpool 2 losing a director, and we got a little bit of reasoning to come out about that. You mentioned a little bit last week that there appears to have been, according to some reports, there appears to have been a dispute over the casting of Cable, but more importantly, the bigger issue appears to have been the overall vision of the movie, in that according to some, there were two totally different movies on the table. This is according to The Wrap and our favorite guy, Umberto Gonzalez. according to him, there were two different movies on the table, one of which had nothing to do with Deadpool, basically. So, or just wasn't Deadpool in tone. So, understandably, the studio went with the vision that Ryan Reynolds, the star, and the writers wanted, which is a movie closer in tone to what we got in the first one. Small budget, potential for a big return on investment, and a more grounded story, so to speak. Well, grounded. Deadpool was grounded.
A smaller story. A more personal, yes. Like a more...
Yeah.
Deadpool, for all its successes, and it had many successes, was not something you would call epic in scope.
Right.
The scope was very narrow, and that, I would argue, was to its benefit.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Deadpool was a movie that knew what it was, which is refreshing because a lot of movies don't seem to know what they are anymore. Go for too much, go for too little, and this was the right tone, and it it's really a little baffling that, that the director would have wanted to change things up so much from the first one. But that being said, from everything that we're reading, and we don't know what's true, we don't know what's not, from everything that we've read, it appears that for the fans, at least in my opinion, you weigh in if you disagree, I feel like it seems like the best decision was made.
I would tend to agree. I mean, we weren't in the rooms. You know, Greg,
no,
we don't...
Not
know,
at all.
Fans will never probably know the full story of what went on here. But, you know, for the most part, hard to disagree with the same writing team and Ryan Reynolds in place. Not that a director is unimportant or you know,
yeah,
virtually interchangeable. It is important. But, you know, if you have to choose between the director or the combination of the original writers and Ryan Reynolds, it's an easy choice there. And, you know, there are candidates already being bandied about to take over the directorial mm-hmm. role. I know Drew Goddard of Daredevil showrunner fame, also TV director Magnus Martins, who I'm not as familiar with, and then one that I know you're probably very, very excited
yes.
about.
He appears to be the leader in the clubhouse right now.
According to reports, you know, which you know what those are worth. But some might say that John Wick co-director David Leitch is reportedly the strong front runner to direct Deadpool 2. So I'm sure you're very excited about that, being the big John Wick fan.
I am a big John Wick fan. In fact, let me tell you folks about John Wick. It's the Austin of modern action movies. It's the, by God, Dr. Death of modern original action films. In my opinion, it's the best modern original action film since Taken. But then again, maybe it's not. It's not for me to say.
So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the update on where Deadpool 2 stands right now. But, Greg, why don't we bounce it on over to the DC side, because DC is also having what I would consider to be far larger and more severe directorial woes right now.
Yes. The feature film The Flash, which was scheduled to start filming or start pre-production early in 2017, well, it's going to be hard to do that now because the movie doesn't have a director. The man who was attached to direct it, who was the dope director, Rick Famuyiwa, who we have talked about and butchered his name before here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. A lot of people were very excited about him being attached to this project over the summer. And at some point, something went wrong. And now, as of this week, Famuyiwa is out of the film. And this is the second time a director has dropped out of the film. Seth Graham Smith, who was previously attached to the project, dropped out back in April. And the reasons being cited right now are creative differences between the studio.
For the second time in 6 months, essentially.
Yes, the studio and the director. And according to rumors, some might say out there that the issue is that allegedly Famuyiwa wanted to make an edgier take on the character than the studio was comfortable with. Which begs the question, why wasn't all of this thought about, oh, I don't know, 6 months ago before they hired the guy to begin with?
Who knows at this point? My larger question is, if you have such a specific version of this movie in mind, if that's really what you want, then Jeff Johns, John Berg, why don't you just make it yourself? At this point, you've separated from two directors. Clearly, you should know somebody who shares your vision, somebody who has worked on the pre-production of one of these movies, or somebody who has an affinity for the character of The Flash that can bring what you want to life. Very concerned. This movie is currently slated for a March 2018 release date. I don't see any way they make that at this point, do you?
Without rushing the film? I don't see it, to be honest. I really don't. I think...
Because of all the standalone DC movies, I think we would both agree The Flash is the one that's going to be the most post-production heavy.
The
VFX needed to finish this movie, it's going to be intense. It's going to be massive.
If anything, I could see them moving around the schedule a little bit. Like, Aquaman, I would think, would get moved maybe into the Flash spot. Was Aquaman scheduled to go after the Flash? I can't remember.
That was the original plan, yes.
I think I could see them moving Aquaman before the Flash. because, you know, you don't want – rushing it would be the worst thing in the world. Rushing it to meet this artificial deadline you created. And in Geoff Johns, I trust. I believe in him. He knows these characters better than anybody. But it worries me for the future of the studio if you develop a reputation for this. Now –
Right, because the thing that we had always been sold on that separated DC films from Marvel films was that filmmakers were going to be allowed to make their films. And judging by what's happened with The Flash thus far, that does not appear to be the case anymore.
And even by what you're seeing with Justice League, which appears to be drastically removed from anything resembling what we've seen from Zack Snyder films in the past.
Right, and I think you and I would both agree they've put forth a massive public relations undertaking by releasing so much Justice League info and Justice footage and, you know, set visits this early. They're trying to win the goodwill of the people back. But when you see reports like this, I mean – it just, as I've said before, I am in a prove it mode when it comes to DC films, and until I see a good one,
they've given us
you have no benefit of the
they've
doubt.
They've given us no reason to give them the benefit of the doubt to this point. But I will say this: if I was talking with Russell Sellers about this the other day, if this is part of a move to, I guess, finally make. If this is basically DC throwing in the towel, Warner Brothers throwing in the towel and saying, okay, we're just going to copy Marvel, I'm actually fine with that at this point. Maybe this is their way of saying, okay, we're going to copy the Kevin Feige approach of one vision shaping this universe of movies, and if you don't like vision or if your vision doesn't match our vision – we're going to move on and find somebody that will direct it the way we want it to. What that leads to, as you've seen in Marvel, is safe movies, but good movies. And at this point, I'll take safe and good over risky and horrible. And
yes, I would agree. So, and it also leads to a greater sense of one cohesive narrative, and one that that weaves in and out between the movies.
And maybe now they're saying, you know what, we tried it this other way, and that for better or worse, no matter how people individually reacted to it, the overall direction wasn't working, the overall approach wasn't working. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to do it the Marvel method, and we're going to outlay our specific visions to whoever wants to come in and put those visions to reality. So if that's the case, all well and good. But that being said, it can't be looked at as a good thing to lose a hot, young, up-and-coming director that people are excited about. So we'll see. Again, we're both of us now in prove-it mode where they're going to have to really show us. I do think Wonder Woman is going to be an interesting case study because I think Wonder Woman is going to be a good, safe movie. And if it is, I think that – and if it's successful, I think that will chart the course for the rest of the DCU.
Right, but you got to remember Wonder Woman was made in a largely – it was made in a time frame where Geoff Johns wasn't yet in full creative control of DC Films. So
true, but he allegedly had a hand in writing the script. So
yes, absolutely. So I have faith that Wonder Woman will be good. I don't know that I necessarily have faith that we can take – if Wonder Woman is good, take that as, you know, the template for what DC films are going to be going forward. I think I'm more interested in the first post-Justice League movie, to be honest. I know that's a long way away. I know it's a long way to wait and see, long time to wait and see. But I think that one, once you have, you know, Zack Snyder kind of done with his, you know, his contribution at that point, and Geoff Johns in full control for an entire pre-production cycle, I think that's going to be a better litmus test. But, you know, that's just my opinion.
Certainly one man's opinion from under the black resist-all hat.
So quickly, let's move over to some comics-related news. Nothing earth-shattering here. You want to go DC or Marvel?
Let's start
first,
Marvel.
Right? Start Marvel. Recently, you know, the news came out from Marvel that the Mockingbird solo title, which had been written by New York Times best-selling prose author Chelsea Kane, was being canceled. When that news came out, Kane took to Twitter to announce Mockingbird is canceled, but she also asked, you know, that we make sure that Marvel makes room for more titles written by women about women kicking ass. A completely innocuous and altogether truthful statement, honestly. It's something that Marvel does need to do. It's something that comics in general need to do. I have zero issue with anything she said, but apparently a lot of people out there did have an issue with what she said.
Well, some might say, even if they shouldn't.
So what exactly happened here, Greg?
I'm honestly – I don't know. I honestly did not follow this controversy that closely. I followed it a little bit, but apparently there was a cover that came out to Mockingbird, I believe, that drew some fire because of a shirt that was on the Mockingbird character. Says, ask me about my feminist agenda. But the main thing was she said that she got a bunch of online harassment from comic book fans about this title and about, you know, her statement about women writing women and all that stuff. And she claims that she basically had never faced this level of harassment until writing comics, and that it made her not want to do comics because you know, the level of vitriol, the level of entitlement, the level of abuse that she faced as a result of this comic book was more than she had faced in all of her years of prose writing, and essentially called out the comics industry for having a problem with misogyny and vocal haters, I guess you would say. So that's my understanding of it. Admittedly, I did not follow this very closely. You know, it's in general, it seems that this is a sad statement because there are a lot of awesome creators out there that interact with fans online, but it seems that interacting with fans on Twitter just doesn't do you any good, it seems, because as we have often said, Twitter is a cesspool by and large. So it brings out the worst in humanity.
It's just sad that you have somebody who is an accomplished mainstream author that Marvel was able to land, and her experience with fans has made her not want to write comics anymore. That's disgusting, guys. I mean, like, what exactly are you attempting to do, and what is your point here? Like, if her vision of Mockingbird isn't for you, don't read it. I mean that's as simple as you can get. Like, I have tons of creators who have visions for characters that I don't agree with, and I may sit here on this show and say bad things about them, but you know what I don't do? Go to Twitter and address them directly, or send them hate mail, or whatever other ridiculous things that you feel you need to do. If you don't like somebody's work, you don't need to contact them and tell them about it. You know, let's just say, for example, you were a fan of pro wrestling and you didn't like a certain wrestler. You wouldn't want to constantly tag that person on Twitter and criticize them, now would you?
Oh, no. And then you certainly wouldn't want to get blocked by said performers and then complain that said performers blocked you.
No, you wouldn't. You would not want to do that.
That's what we call trolling.
Yes, people.
That is not,
and it's not a positive term. As much as you may wear it as a badge of honor at times, it's a douchey, stupid thing to do.
It really is, and it it's not the behavior of a mature person.
It really
isn't.
It's the
behavior of a 16-year-old desperate for attention.
Absolutely.
And,
so,
you know, it's unfortunate. And the one area, I guess, that I would disagree with her on is I don't feel that it's isolated to comics. I do think that it's in greater percentages.
Not isolated, but yes, I would. I don't think her
wrestling
point was that
and
it was
comics. Unfortunately, yes. The two things I love the most have two of the most destructive fan bases.
I would agree.
In all of fandom. You don't see, at least I haven't seen, Star Wars and Star Trek fans, or Star Trek fans, whatever that is, get so worked up that they launch attacks at the creators and the performers in their shows. In fact, generally, they like the performers on their shows, even if it's not their preferred take on the property. It's very simple, folks. If you don't like it, don't read it. And in my opinion, you are well within your rights to say to whoever you want, I don't like this, and this is why I don't like this. I don't like this performance because I don't like this performance. But where you go wrong is when you go out of your way to tell people that they suck at what they do. Because absolutely. I don't think, you know, I'll speak for myself. I work in public relations. I write every day, a bunch. I wouldn't want someone who I've never met before, who doesn't work in my profession, to come to me in the middle of the workday, tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, you're a horrible human being. You forgot to put a period at the end of that sentence. You deserve to die, and I hope that your family all dies in a fire. I wouldn't appreciate that. I don't think anyone would appreciate that. And that's what you're doing when you send people direct messages because you didn't like some piece of their work that they did.
Absolutely. So
get over it.
In summary, grow the fuck up and move on.
That's right. That's right. Amen, that's right. To quote the great philosopher of our time, Joey Mims.
Absolutely.
And on to a more pleasant topic. The JLA, Justice League of America, is coming out in February for DC Comics as part of the second wave of Rebirth. Mm-hmm. And now we finally have the completed team, at least the launch team, of this book that's going to be written by Steve Orlando, I believe. And this team is comprises, depending on how the proper usage of that term is, Batman, who is, I'm assuming, organizing the team, The Ray, Black Canary, Vixen, Killer Frost, The Atom, and...
Here we go.
The main man's back, baby. The real and only true Lobo.
Now, I actually read something that somehow they are going to have this version of Lobo actually be the New 52 Lobo, just redesigned to be the original Lobo somehow. That they are somehow going to technically be the same character.
However they have to explain it, I don't care. It's the main.
Me neither, because can we all agree that metrosexual Lobo was one of the worst ideas ever?
It was terrible. It was so
bad. It missed the entire point of the character. The entire point of Lobo as a character is to be a relic of the 90s. It's to be that over-the-top, almost like DC's version of Deadpool. That's what he
Absolutely.
Is supposed to be.
Absolutely.
And so here's why are you trying to make him into something?
He was always over-the-top. From the time that he became a big deal in the early 90s, Simon Bisley and all those – Alan Grant, all that stuff, he was written to be deliberately over-the-top and obnoxious like Guy Gardner was at the time, who was also always supposed to be over-the-top and obnoxious. That's how they were written. That's designed. That is Lobo. And I will say this. We weren't doing a podcast at the time. But the new 52 Villains Month Lobo issue that introduced this slimmer, more fashion-sensible version of Lobo was one of the worst comics I read in the entire New 52 initiative. Bad, annoying dialogue, bad, annoying narration, and a stupid, unnecessary redesign – stop me if you've heard that before in the New 52 – of a character who was fine and didn't need to be redesigned. So this is the main man coming back, and I'm excited to see how he reacts and how he interacts with Batman in particular, because I don't know that we've seen too many instances of Batman and Lobo interacting in the comics. It's typically
it should be a lot like that episode of Justice of the animated series where Lobo took Superman a lot in the Justice League for a little bit.
Yep. And Steve Orlando, the writer, for what it's worth, has said that this is not going to be a permanent fixed team. He is a supporter of the idea of a rotating lineup in Justice League, which was done back in the 80s, I believe, and also, of course, he actually cited Justice League Unlimited as an example of his ideal Justice League, and so we can expect to see new faces coming in and going from the team, possibly Green Arrow. That was the big surprise to me in this lineup, as I figured when Black Canary was in, the Green Arrow would be in also. So I would expect him to show up at some point. But what do you make of this lineup, Nick? Very, very unique and interesting lineup here of characters.
I like it. For Batman, Black Canary, and Lobo alone, I mean, not to you know, say that I'm not interested in Vixen and Killer Frost, which I am interested in those two characters in particular, but that triumvirate of Batman, Lobo, and Black Canary has me very interested to see how they will interact with another. Batman having dual citizenship, essentially, in both leagues also is interesting to me, so... Mm-hmm. I'm into this. I'm going to give this a shot. I haven't been a huge fan of a lot of the stuff I've read from Mr. Orlando, but I'm at least going to give this a try, and hopefully it will impress me and find its way onto my pull list.
Yes, I wonder if this is going to be similar or not to a concept that I actually made in our initial pitches a couple years ago when we did our first Place to Be Nation fantasy comics draft. Where I had Wolverine in my quote unquote Justice League book, and he was also on the side, secretive from everybody else, running this team of outsiders. Basically, I don't remember what I called it. That was kind of like operating under the radar from the main league. So I wonder if that's going to be the angle they go with here, which is similar to the outsiders concept, I guess, from back in the day. So interesting. Also, another question for you, Nick. Do you think that Killer Frost will be handled more as a hero because of potential storyline ramifications from the TV show that may be coming up soon?
I would have to think that plays a role. I don't know how big of a role it plays, but I bet it had at least had to be a contributing factor. You would think.
You would think, certainly, because
I don't think they want to turn Danielle Panabaker's Caitlin Snow into a villain. That's just not full-time anyway.
I agree. I agree with that. So anyway, that brings us to the end of the rundown, and we're going to pitch to the commercial, and then when we come back, because this is off the page, and I don't think we've mentioned that once in this episode yet, this is off the page, and we are going to be looking at an oft-forgotten bit of Marvel animation from 2007, the feature film Doctor Strange, the Sorcerer Supreme, which is appropriate because the live-action movie Doctor Strange opens this weekend across the country. So, across both our wonderful countries, Canada and the United States. And you know, this is we're going to give it a look and see what we thought about it and discuss some of the intricacies of this film, and we'll do that right after this commercial break. But before we go to the break, wanted to let everybody know, and a little bit of commercial advertisement on my own end here, both Nick and I recently were guest stars on the illustrious Ben Morse show Place to Be Nation Rewind, which you can catch right now at placetobenation.com. PTB and Rewind, we joined our good buddy Ben to talk about No Mercy 2002, Al Wilson being sexed to death, and Katie Vick being sexed back to life, and any number of interesting storylines from this show, No Mercy 2002. So go check that out right here on Place to Be Nation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And we are about to take you off the page. This is, of course, where we look at pieces of comic book media that are not comic books, movies, games, television shows, etc. And in this case, we found a pretty timely topic of discussion. As everybody knows...
And by we, he means me.
And as everybody knows, this weekend marks the grand opening of Doctor Strange, the live-action...
Oh, you didn't do it in your Grant Morrison accent like you did last week.
Doctor Strange! I was trying to do more of a Dracula voice, actually, but if you're doing Grant Morrison, it would be, Doctor Strange!
Grant Morrison, Dracula.
Spectre!
Same thing.
It will open. It's the latest part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, wildly successful cinematic universe, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. And will open across theaters nationwide this weekend. Well, we decided to revisit one of the only other adaptations of the Doctor Strange mythos, which is a little seen, little bought Doctor Strange animated movie from 2007, produced by Lionsgate. This was part of a continuing series of Marvel animated standalone films, and they had done an Iron Man movie not long before this.
The Invincible Iron Man, yeah, it came out not long before this.
The Invincible Iron Man, or Iron Man, if you will. Mm-hmm. And this was, keep in mind, pre-Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is right. This movie's from 2007, so pretty strange to strange, get it? To take two characters like Iron Man and Doctor Strange and give them animated.
Iron Man makes some level of sense because you would think that the Iron Man theatrical film was probably well into pre-production by the time that movie was released. So perhaps it was, you know, kind of testing the waters and introducing kids and that kind of thing to the concept of Iron Man in a way they may not have been in the past. But you're right, this Doctor Strange one in particular seems like an exceptionally odd pull for Marvel, especially in a line of, you know, ongoing, what at that point was a series of origin stories. You would have thought a Captain America, maybe even a Thor, any number of things would have made a little bit more sense than Doctor Strange, who, what, C-list at best, probably?
In terms of stature, certainly. Not many people know much about Doctor Strange. So, it's from, in terms of mainstream, not hardcore Marvel fans, obviously.
Right.
Don't string me up here, folks. But certainly an interesting pull, and the sales would seem to reflect that. But nonetheless, we watched this here for our off the page segment and decided to take a look at this. And for Nick and I both, this is a bit of an introduction to Doctor Strange, because I can only speak for myself, but I believe this also applies to Nick. I don't know really the first thing about Doctor Strange. I don't know anything about the Eye of Agamotto or Agamemnon or whatever. I don't know about Baron von Raschke or any
Baron
of these.
Mordo.
I don't know anything about Dormanto.
Dormammu.
I don't know anything about these
characters. The Dread Dormammu.
So this was all, and I certainly didn't know anything about Wang.
Wong.
Oh, that's right. This was all new to me. This was all information. My main exposure to Doctor Strange is through the Marvel Ultimate Alliance games. And, you know, that's pretty much the extent of my Doctor Strange knowledge. And I guess he may have popped up on some of the Marvel animated series back in the 90s, but I don't remember him. So what about you, Nick? What was your knowledge of Doctor Strange going into this?
My knowledge of Doctor Strange has been greatly enhanced just in recent weeks. I've been kind of working through a little side project, trying to, you know, read some Marvel history, trying to bone up a little bit, so to speak. And I've actually been going back through the fantastic Marvel Unlimited app and reading some of the earliest Strange Tales issues, some of the early adventures of Doctor Strange. And I will say, very, very unique for its time, groundbreaking in a lot of ways.
Steve Ditko and Stan Lee, correct?
I was about to say, the Steve Ditko plotting and art is just very, very unique for that time period. So I was introduced to a lot of the concepts that are in this movie before sitting down to watch this movie. Stuff like the Eye of Agamotto, the Dread Dormammu, Baron Mordo, the Ancient One, various other characters like that. So I was probably a little bit more, you know, up and up on my Strange history than you were coming into this.
Right. I mean, I had heard of the Ancient One Billy Gunn, but certainly not the Ancient One in the context of Doctor Strange. So that was, you know, sort of unique, if you will. Mm-hmm. This film, Lionsgate produced it, as mentioned. And what we're going to do is what we do always with Off the Page. We're not going to watch the whole movie this time, we promise. But if you want to pull up, if you have a copy of this movie, or if you have access to Hulu, you can pull this movie up. Just search for Doctor Strange. Spell out Doctor.
Or, as I found out today, you can go to dailymotion.com and find the Indian language dubbed version if you want to watch that.
Which actually sounds pretty awesome. So I kind of wish I had watched that version, to be honest with you. But
Craig.
You can type in Doctor Strange, spell out Doctor, and you can find it on Hulu. And if you want to follow along with us, we've got it paused right now. I've got it paused at 3 seconds into the Hulu feed. It's on the Lionsgate logo. And what we're going to do is we're going to get you to hit play alongside us. And we're going to get you to do that right now. So this is a movie that features some pretty notable voice talent on it in some roles. Tara Strong plays a very, very minor role.
Did she really?
In this, yes. She does the voice of Doctor Strange's sister. His sister, who he has an uncomfortably close relationship with in the film. By the way, I don't know. Was I the only one that noticed that, Nick? I mean, it was a little off-putting the way that they animated them together.
I noticed it a little bit, but yeah.
I mean, she straddles.
And what's exceptionally weird is, like, I tried to do a little Wikipedia research on that character. I think she was a creation just for this movie. Because when you go and you Google April Strange, the only thing that pops up is, like, April Strange as a character of Marvel Universe Earth 2272, which apparently is the Earth specifically created for this movie. So, I don't think she exists in the larger 616 universe.
I don't either. You also have you have heavy hitters in this movie like Josh Keaton and Phil LaMarr, who have done major voice work.
Oh, who did Phil LaMarr do?
He's just listed as additional voice on IMDb.
Oh, wow.
Josh Keaton also listed as additional voice. He was the voice of Hal Jordan in the excellent Green Lantern animated series, which we
not to get you off topic, but let's talk a little about what's going on screen real quick. Here the movie is opening and these citizens are being chased by this mythical beast or whatever, and we're introduced for the first time to this team of sorcerers. And you right here you see, I think, five characters on screen. I'm pretty sure only two of them actually get speaking parts, major speaking parts throughout the rest of the film.
Including one of them who is wearing the most impractical attire imagined. This chick that's wearing the unbuttoned leather jacket with a bra and a thong underneath, what is that all about?
I must have missed that one.
She's the one with the pale white skin. You don't see her much because it's all about Mordo with his sword that glows and fighting this dragon thing. Yeah, this was an utterly confusing intro. I'm not going to lie. I did not like this intro at all. It sort of took me out of the movie from the get-go because I'm not given names for these characters at this point. They're just nameless, faceless people fighting a not really intimidating-looking dragon creature.
Right. I think the idea here is to put you on the same level as the character of Doctor Strange and that you're both being introduced to worlds you don't fully know or understand.
But wouldn't the logical approach be to introduce you to Doctor Strange first? And then show him getting exposed to this weird, bizarre stuff?
I would agree. And I would say that, yeah, I probably would have done that as well. In a slight defense of this opening, I will say, with the exception of the CGI tornado thing we're seeing right now and the cars, I thought the animation on this was pretty good. It was one of the bright spots in this movie that kind of has – the animation here in this film, as we'll discuss, I'm sure
– X-Men like, Evolution-esque.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. What I would say is that it waxes and wanes, because when it's bad, it's really bad. But there are moments where it's pretty good, and it's so odd to see a movie that fluctuates so wildly in the quality of its animation.
Man, these cars. What is...
Yeah.
The cars look like they're out of Telltale Game.
They do, and I mean, this is a similar concept they used in The Killing Joke, when last we did an off the page on an animated film, where they, for some reason, have an obsession with CGI-ing Or using CGI to create, you know, traffic for whatever reason. And strangely enough, Jay Oliva was the director on that, and he's worked on a lot of the DC animated movies recently. Jay Oliva was the director on this Doctor Strange film, I should say.
Yeah, which I wanted to go back to the cast real quick. The one character that we've really had with a speaking part thus far is Mordo. Not Baron Mordo in the movie, but Mordo,
yes.
Who is voiced by Kevin Michael Richardson, who is a very well-known voice actor. He did the voice of Kilowog on the Green Lantern animated series.
Oh, nice.
So two Green Lantern alums here.
You also got Wong with a little bit of a speaking part here.
That's
really going.
By Paul Nakauchi. I would argue that of all the prominent speaking roles in this movie, Kevin Michael Richardson's Mordo is really the only good one. I thought the rest of the cast was varied between bad and just wholly unremarkable. Wong and the Ancient One, very unremarkable. Stephen Strange and especially Dr. Gina Atwater. So bad.
Yeah. Strange I thought was okay. I thought Wong and the Ancient One were actually pretty good. I wasn't as high on Mordo as you were. I thought it was very generic mustache twirling villain a lot of the time.
Certainly, but at least when he delivered dialogue, I didn't cringe.
Right, but I would agree that pretty much anything involving the Strange and Atwater subplot was cringe-worthily bad. I mean, the whole deal from beginning to end, even with the attempted redemption moment at the end, like, ugh, the worst. The absolute worst.
A weak female character.
Yes.
And
an uninteresting dynamic between her and the main character. Like,
they don't appear to even be in love with each other. They don't appear to have really any connection to one another.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, comics and comic book properties have been littered throughout history with weak female characters, but they are made useful and made interesting through their connection to the main character. Here, she doesn't even have a real connection to the main character that makes you get emotionally invested in any way.
And again, so, not to belabor the point, but Bryce Johnson, who does the voice of Doctor Strange here, I just feel like he's totally the wrong fit. When he tries to deliver the heart-wrenching dialogue that's supposed to tug. He's fine when he's saying magic shit. When he's saying, when he's talking about, Agamotto and Dormammu and all that crap, he's fine. But when he actually has to deliver emotional lines.
I want to pause here and call you out a little bit because you're, magic shit and Dormammu and all that crap. Now, Greg,
I'm not saying that.
It sounds a bit dismissive here that you're dismissing the concept out of hand.
No, I'm not dismissing the concept out of hand. Listen, I will be the first to admit the magic sides of the DC and Marvel universes are not my bag, baby, so to speak. But I'm not dismissing them out of hand. They're fine. I have nothing against them. Even you would have to admit, though, I think fans of these concepts would have to admit most of the verbiage that is used in magic comics is just BS. It's just gibberish. Just the same way that technology terminology in comics is usually just gibberish. It's fine. When I say magic shit, I'm just saying, when you're saying the usual stuff that you say in magic comics, which is, a bunch of spells with weird names. The exception being or saying something backwards like Zatanna does or doing the rhyming deal that the demon does, they have similar trains of thought, if you will. So, he's saying, the eye of whatever, I think DC is the eye of Horus or whatever. The eye of Agamotto. There's other, casting spells and whatnot.
The only unfortunate thing here is not one time does he say, by the hoary hosts of Hoggoth.
Which is a big mistake, in my opinion.
Which is one of his catchphrases in the old. Yeah, there's him looking creepily at a picture of him and his sister hugging. So that
good
was
lord, we're going to get into the incest. What is it with? Why do we keep coming back to incest subplots on the Hard Traveling Fanboys?
Well, quite frankly, we are from the South.
That's true. We are from the South. What I was trying to say is the actor is fine when he's doing the superhero stuff, when he's doing the magic stuff, when he's. He's gathered with the team and all that, but what
I would
he's
go so
is
far
doing
as
the emotion stuff.
So yeah, I wouldn't even necessarily restrict it to superhero stuff. I would agree with you about emotional stuff when he's trying to go bigger, like when he's trying to even add anger or some sort of yelling into the mix,
right.
Or if he's trying to be emotional, it doesn't work. But even scenes like this is going on screen right now, where it's a quiet, just a guy having a normal conversation. He's fine. I think his reading of the lines comes off as natural, and it sounds like a normal person's cadence or whatever. But any time he tries to inject emotion into it or go big, it that's when it goes off the rails. Especially in his very odd choices for gasps or sounds of shock, which are oof, they are Professor Xavier level.
I was about to say reminiscent of
And here we go with the Atwater character who starts off as an annoying, uninteresting character and never gets any better. But I mean, in a brief moment of defense for the character, can you really blame her for being annoying? Because okay, in this scene that we're getting here with Doctor Strange, the comparison you most naturally want to draw is to someone like Tony Stark in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, who is a very arrogant character, from the get-go, but he has a certain level of charisma and a certain level of charm that endear you to him before he becomes Iron Man. There is nothing endearing about Stephen Strange at this point in this movie.
He is
an out-and-out jerk. Like,
yeah.
There is nothing to make you care about the journey this character is about to go on. And almost in a way, when tragedy finds him and his hands, are the nerves in his hands are irreparably damaged, you almost think, man, you kind of had it coming, you know?
Yeah. Do you get the impression – this movie came out in 2007. Do you get the impression that the people that made this movie might have been watching a hit television show called House at the time?
Oh, they had to have been. They had to have been. I mean, they modeled him so clearly after House.
After House. And the problem is they forget that what made House work is that House was extremely charismatic.
Absolutely.
This Stephen Strange ain't got much in the way of charisma. And if you're uncharismatic and you're an asshole, you're just an asshole.
Absolutely.
So
pause for a minute. Oh, pause.
Yep.
All right. I got to make an emergency dump. I'll be right back.
I love it. I love emergency dumps. I don't love them for me, but they're funny when they happen to others. Oh, fudge. What is going on?
All right, sorry about that.
Did you shit?
I did.
Good.
All right, you tell me when you're ready.
What were we talking about?
You led off with, if you're not a charismatic asshole, it just makes you an asshole.
Yep, all right.
Did you pause the movie too?
I did.
All right, ready? 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, so, you know, here we see asshole Stephen Strange, and he's introduced to this problem that he really doesn't have any interest in solving, involving children who are suffering from deadly illnesses.
From crippling deadly illnesses. Now,
brain diseases.
I think if I don't even know if this is the case, Greg, but perhaps maybe they're trying to get over the idea or set up the idea that he doesn't want to take the case because it reminds him too much of his sister, who was also young when she was afflicted by some sort of brain ailment. Or am I giving them too much credit here?
You know, I feel like you might be giving them a little bit too much credit. But, you know, we've seen the entire movie. So we can look back on it and say, okay, retroactively, that's probably the reason that he's like that. But there's nothing in the animation or the dialogue or the performance that betrays any sort of sympathies that he might have in this situation.
I will also say that the dialogue here between Strange and Atwater is Robert Kirkman-esque in that both characters are clearly explaining to each other what their positions and who each other are. Atwater just explaining who Doctor Strange is as a character at this point to Doctor Strange, and Strange doing the same thing to Atwater at times. It's exceptionally on the nose.
Right, and here again is the girlfriend and boyfriend-esque picture of Dr. Stephen Strange and his sister.
Yes, it is odd. And also, what kind of hospital does this dude work at with apparently like 45-foot high ceilings in his office? His office looks like a freaking classroom from Harry Potter or something.
I think his office is actually located in Stamford, Connecticut.
That's possible.
That's all I can figure. And okay, because when you first saw these scenes before we got this flashback, did you not think that picture was of Stephen Strange and his wife?
I assumed it was of some girlfriend. I almost thought of it. It might have been of Atwater, you know, before a unfortunate hair dyeing accident. But I wasn't really sure.
A truly bizarre prank, and now she straddles him and playfully punches at his chest as he. This is just very uncomfortable. I mean, where was all this leading?
Like, I don't know.
Listen,
to a massive aneurysm, apparently.
Hey, Professor Xavier-like aneurysm. She must have tried to use her powers.
Yeah, incredible power.
In any event, here you see an inexplicably green fog lift over New York as sewage waste apparently permeates.
Well, it's the, you know, smog and, you know, things of that sort, air quality, something.
And Steven's – this is my favorite part right here. When he's driving the car and he's about to spin out here in cartoonish fashion. Wait for it. Oh, come on.
You're going to be waiting for a minute because he's got to go through the tunnel and do the whole deal.
Oh, yeah, he's got to shift through the stations and see the Dormammu's mug pop up in the middle of the road. There he is.
The Dread Dormammu, as he's often referred to in the comics.
The comics.
But not referred to here.
No. Just like they dropped the Baron from Mordo, which is fine by me.
Well, because here he's a pupil of the Ancient One. If he'll become a Baron down the road.
He'll become one of many Marvel Barons.
And one of many Marvel Barons. It's kind of like Dr. Doom. He had to go to evil medical school before he could become.
He would have become Dr. Doom.
But he was just Doom, and then he became Dr. Doom. So that's different.
He was never even referred to as Mr. Doom at any point.
Nope. Nor should he have been.
Nor should he have been, no.
But yeah, so here's the slow motion car accident thing.
How many times did he spin, by the way?
I have no idea.
It felt like 400. It felt.
I think it was only three or four.
Now,
to be,
wait for it. And the car falls again. There we go. Just
yep.
Papers.
One last.
Papers everywhere. My holds! Bring me back my holds!
But yeah, this is the one element of the Doctor Strange mythos that I, from what I know anyway, is fairly consistent. The car crash that damages the nerves in his hands. I think that is the radioactive spider in this scenario.
Yes.
It's the one thing that's always present.
His gimmick is that his hands are damaged and he's a world famous surgeon of some kind. Here he's a neurosurgeon.
Yes.
And he can't use his hands, and thus things go badly for him, and his ego is damaged and all that. But,
right.
Which, by the way, one of the things that I was going to point out on this episode, it feels to me, obviously neither of us have seen the new movie, I'm pretty sure that this animated movie is kind of similar to how the live-action movie is going to be laid out, just presumably mm-hmm. much, much better.
Right. Well, I mean, that kind of makes sense, because this movie is very much superhero origin 101. And I think – I know you're not high on the idea of origin movies anymore in Marvel films, but I would argue for
Doctor Strange.
For a character like Doctor Strange who the public consciousness hasn't really had a chance to catch up with yet, I think you got to have it for Doctor Strange.
I agree.
And, and that's one thing I'll say about this movie is I find myself engaged by a lot of the plot and a lot of the concepts. And I just find the execution to be lacking at times. So if anything, I would say that watching this has actually made me more excited for the theatrical version because I'm excited to see these concepts and themes executed better than they are here.
And particularly allowed to room to breathe because Lord
almighty. This is something we talk about
the
all
basic.
The time whenever we do one of these animated movies, Greg, is – for whatever reason, for these direct-to-DVD animated movies, both Marvel and DC are so attached to that 70 to 75 minute format that nothing ever has room to breathe except for the Killing Joke, which didn't need the room it was given. So I mean, it's
well, but I'll say this: I think the DC animated movies and even some of the other Marvel animated movies did a better job of being efficient with their time than this. Like something like – you think about something like Batman Under the Red Hood, a movie with pretty much the exact same runtime as this one.
Right.
And just – I mean, I know I'm comparing this to one of the best, but that was just such an efficient movie, economical movie. Even something like Superman Batman Public Enemies, which I would argue is not a perfect adaptation of the book – but does a good enough job of, you know, cutting a brisk pace. And this does not. This is not a brisk pace. This is it varies between glacial and so rapid fire that it's impossible to invest. We're about to get into a part of the movie where Stephen Strange travels the world trying to heal his hands in a just dreadful montage.
I also find it confusing during this sequence of the film. What exactly can his hands do and what can't they
do?
Because
as you
here
can
we
see,
just saw him struggling with opening, you know, putting a key in a lock. Here we're going to see him, okay, he's got the shaving cream on his face.
The shaving cream, that's
fine. But can't shave.
He's too weak to shave.
Later on, he takes a map from Wong and is able to unfurl the map.
He just uses his broken damaged hands to pull a Willem Dafoe-like clearing of the table by swatting all of these items off the table.
And in theory, he would have had to hit the button on this Bluetooth set he's wearing, so how did he do that? Later on, he's climbing mountains with his hands. So I'm very confused as to, in this movie, what exactly his hands can do and what they can't do.
How do people in this movie, by the way, Nick, how do they get their hair to do that thing that it's doing in the front?
I have not a clue. Perhaps they could ask Jorge Corona, artist of The Flash number 9.
Very good, Mr. Lau. Very good throwback there. Callback, even.
And here, look at this person arbitrarily hitting buttons.
It seems as if he's doing it. Oh, this is part of the montage. He's flying right now, Stephen Strange. So as Dr. Strange, he tries to go around the world to heal his hands because he's going to spare no expense. And we're given the impression that he is not only a wealthy doctor, but he appears to be an abnormally wealthy doctor in that he lives in a sky-rise penthouse, and now he's going around the world spending too much money, apparently, and now he's pretty much loses his fortune, no longer has money, can't even sign his name properly, even though he does get it signed eventually.
Even though the name just pops up on the check, even though the animation shows the pen not even anywhere near the end of the signature.
That's neither here nor there. He's gripping the phone, but he's just shaking a lot. So
And in theory, he would have had to put the coins in the slot, right? Like he would have had to actually use the
payphone. Right. The implication that I'm getting from him is that he's got the same illness that Rocky had at the beginning of Rocky V that then vanished and never appeared again in the rest of the series.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about the cast. The animation is an area where I think we don't you're a little bit higher on it than I am. I don't think it's horrible.
It's got its bad moments for sure, but I would say solid, you know, like solid for the most part, with moments of really, really bad and a couple of pretty good moments thrown in there.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the comparison that I would make to this whole movie is the way it's written and the way it's animated. It feels to me, you know, see here, this isn't bad. This is pretty good animation here.
Yeah.
But it feels to me at times like an early 2000s. And I originally said late 90s, but the look of it is early 2000s. Like an early 2000s Cartoon Network show, something like maybe like The Batman or X-Men Evolution, something like that. Mm-hmm. But the writing feels like early 90s cartoon, like very on the nose, very generic, nothing to write home about. Everything is – I feel like you could take stock characters out of this and replace them with stock characters from, say, Gargoyles. And it would be – which is a good show, but it would be kind of the same type deal. So you know, just not a very remarkable. Paint by the numbers, I would describe this project as. Paint by the numbers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like I said, it's very origin story 101. Like, it's not seeking to impart any deeper understanding of any of these characters. It is an introductory level course at best.
And keep in mind, we're how far are we into this movie thus far? We're 22 minutes into the movie, and he hasn't even made it to his training yet. He hasn't even encountered the Ancient One yet.
That part of it doesn't really bug me a ton. I guess because I'm so used to this 72-minute format and these movies having to move so rapidly. And make no mistake, this movie will begin to move rapidly later on.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it doesn't bug me when it seems like they're actually taking their time and being deliberate about setting up the order.
Yeah, but see, here's the problem. My problem is when they choose to be deliberate. If you're going to be deliberate, don't be deliberate with Doctor Strange trying to get his hand fixed. Be deliberate with him learning all of this crap that he learns in the span of about 10 minutes in the movie. Where
you
suddenly
keep sounding like Hollywood Rock, all this unrealistic crap.
What you going to do? You have him go to this mystical.
See here, holding the map. No problem. Got the map.
Climbing a mountain.
Climbing mountains. No problem. But I don't understand the science. What are the rules you have defined for these hands? Like, how do they work and what don't they work on? Because it seems rather arbitrary.
Hands. How do they work? He goes to this mystical Ra's al Ghul like snowy mountain that doesn't exist until he finds it. And he gets there. Okay, this has all been about this journey, right? And we see his journey. And at a point later in the movie, which we're not going to watch the whole damn thing, so I might as well skip ahead to that. We see him later on be told about what magic is and that magic exists, learn it in a span of 3 or 4 minutes, really, master it in the span of another 4 or 5 minutes, and then become the Sorcerer Supreme about 10 minutes later.
Right, because it was, quote, his destiny.
I understand slowdowns would be much welcome in movies like this, but I would have rather them sped through the whole, you know, I'm an asshole and my hands don't work. Speed through that and get me to him learning how to become the Sorcerer Supreme and telling me, by the way, what the Sorcerer Supreme is. What does it mean exactly?
Well, you see, he's the Supreme Sorcerer.
Sorcerer, right? But what's that? We're also told.
Of all the sorcerers, he's the Supreme One. Like,
right, but how many sorcerers are there? Who answers
lots.
To him?
I mean, all these other people. All these other lackeys that are running around right now.
The people that are training in martial arts for some reason?
Well, you know, you can't count on magic all the time.
you have to have Aikido in your back pocket to pull out if your magic doesn't work. But no, I mean, I get it. I understand it. I mean, I understand the premise, but it's like I could have used a little more explaining the rules of magic in this movie and why the Ancient One – who the Ancient One is, for that matter, why he has this role, how long has this role existed, why is it their duty to protect the realm from magicians and all that crap, you know, all that crap. Again, I'm not saying that to be dismissive of it. I mean, I say that just in a lighthearted fashion. The same way I would say superhero crap, you know? You know, bad guys, good guys, they punch each other, and then they get along, you know? And Joe's doll is Joe.
Indeed.
And here you see Mordo, putting Doctor Strange in a hammerlock, which is a wrestling hold.
Ah, we should have... I wonder where Earl is during all this.
Earl actually is the Ancient One.
That makes it a lot better.
It really does.
And that's one thing I'm looking forward to about the movie, actually, is the idea of not the Ancient One, not being just generic old Asian guy. I kind of dig the Tilda Swinton reimagining of that character. Kind of takes it away from some of his more racially questionable trappings.
The Ancient One here is essentially Master Splinter.
Master Splinter or, you know, the Kung Fu guy or
Master Po.
Any number of generic wise Asian characters. who I would argue they also have Wong serving the role of as well.
Right, right. Which Wong would be fine. I mean, Wong clearly seems to be his Alfred, I guess you would say, but
yes.
You know, there's the girl I was talking about. Look at her with her open leather jacket and her bra.
Oh, and random Irish accented Seamus looking guy that is only in the movie for one scene apparently.
And yet would be David Sunday's favorite character if he ever watched the movie.
Why is that?
Because he's
the Irish accent.
Yes, yeah, the Irish accent and the red hair.
Gotcha.
But the and what is the necklace that Wong is wearing? Because we were told about the Eye of Agamotto. But
they are all wearing some sort of symbol of their order, I suppose. Because earlier, all their necklaces glowed a different color whenever they were getting ready to go into battle or something. I'm not exactly sure what the details.
This
but
scene,
each of them is wearing.
This scene was particularly, I thought, boring and poorly animated and poorly.
Yes, the animation in this scene in particular is probably some of the worst in the entire movie, especially on the Shadow Hounds. I thought it was
awful. Yeah, I couldn't tell what was supposed to be happening. That was terrible. That little like Predator vision.
Yes.
Oh my God. Anyway, but I couldn't tell what was happening in most of this. Like, there are like two characters that die apparently off screen, I guess, and then there's one or two characters that get mortally wounded and brought back to the base. But I'm not entirely sure how or why or what happens to them exactly. It's a very strange scene. It reminds me of, like, no one's going to get this reference because I'm pretty sure I was the only kid in America that watched this cartoon. There was a Double Dragon cartoon that came on USA in the mid-90s that was not good. But
no.
This scene reminds me of it because the premise of that was similar. There were, like, these shadow creatures that what were their names? Billy and Jimmy would fight.
And one of them was Scott Baio, right?
I think maybe. And they would fight these shadow creatures.
In the Double Dragon theatrical movie, I'm pretty sure one of them was Scott Baio.
Well, yeah, but not in the cartoon.
Yeah, well, who cares about that?
You know, it was a USA show. Anyway, so they would go around, they'd fight these shadow creatures. And, you know, Jimmy was the rebel with a heart of gold, but was a tough guy. And then Billy was the goody two-shoes. And, you know, it was like every other cartoon back then that I watched. But
Jimmy and Billy.
That's what this reminds me of. And that's not a good comparison, really, to make. Not in its favor. Here you get actually, I don't think they really – they show you later on that Mordo is a little bit unhinged. Mordo is a warrior first and a thinker second, and his decision-making in the field tends to cost lives because he's so reckless. Think of him as Shane to throw it back to the Walking Dead universe. He's a kind of rough around the edges, you know, hit first, ask questions later kind of guy.
And he also has, you know, clearly some delusions of grandeur and aspirations for greater power.
Yes, he wants to ascend to the position of Sorcerer Supreme at one point later in the film when the Ancient One appears to finally be close to death because when they want him to seem like all-powerful, he'll show up and he'll, you know, wipe people away with his magic. But then when they want him to appear close to death, they'll have him cough a few times.
Yeah, have him cough a few times. He and Steve Ditko's Aunt May would probably make a good couple.
Actually, the Ancient One's actually younger than Steve Ditko's Aunt May. Anyway,
once again, somewhere Todd Weber is playing a certain rendition of a certain Kansas song.
That's right. And we love it, by the way.
We do.
I don't know why it hasn't become a hit yet.
So here, I guess we should talk about the plot of this movie. Seems to be that the Dread Dormammu is using some sort of magical loophole to send magical creatures into our world for the purposes of destabilizing it for some reason.
He pops up towards the end of the movie, and he
They're trying to get to the Sanctum Sanctorum, which is in New York, but they're not staying in New York to protect the Sanctum Sanctorum. They're staying in Tibet for some reason. And so the magical creatures are trying to open the gateway at the Sanctum Sanctorum to let Dormammu through so that he may conquer this realm. I believe
Stan loves him some New York.
Yes.
So basically your world domination deal, you know, Dormammu wants to come into the the Doctor Strange animated universe and conquer it. But you know, he doesn't really make clear in the film what his plans are. He shows up near the end and says a few things, not much really. You really don't get much about Dormammu. Dormammu is, for people that have complained that the Marvel movies sometimes have one-dimensional villains, Dormammu is like a half-dimensional villain.
Yes, in this movie.
In this movie, not in the comics.
And he just caressed her chin as he was about to kiss her. It was odd. It was exceptionally odd.
I think that we're getting to the root of some of Stephen Strange's issues here.
Yes.
I don't think that he regrets that his sister died. As much as he regrets what he did with his sister before she died.
Or after she died in true Katie Vick fashion.
Oh, man, tying it into our appearance on PTBN Rewind right here.
That's called corporate synergy is what that's called.
That's right. You can hear our thoughts about Booker T and Goldust versus Chris Jericho and Christian.
Absolutely.
And here you see a passage of time for some reason. And
he's building his confidence in his ability to carry rocks or something.
Oh, now he's got a blanket. Look at that.
Yes, you have to earn comfort here. So
that's right.
Every little thing he gets is a remarkable achievement for some reason. This is actually a pretty cool concept, the way they draw the city that the Ancient One lives in. I kind of like the way that's drawn. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting visual concept. You know, up onto the mountain.
Oh, yes. And I'm really excited about what they're going to do with that in the live-action movie, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the visuals of the live-action movie are the most exciting part. I'm looking forward to seeing those. And hopefully we will both have our thoughts on that on next week's show, correct?
I believe that will be the case, assuming that I survive the coming days.
Indeed.
Yes, and here – so we've gotten over the plot. We've gone over the acting. We've gone over the animation. And basically what we've gotten to, if you can't tell, is a lot of filling time with jokes and – anecdotes, because there's honestly not a lot to say about this.
No, it's just really unremarkable.
It's unremarkable.
Greg is probably a little bit lower on it than I am, but I, like, as I told Greg, you know, before that we started the show, this is almost the worst thing we could ever have done an off the page on, because it inspires me with a lack of opinions. Like, I don't have strong feelings about this in any way, shape, or form. It's not... There are good moments, there are terrible moments, but for the most part, it's a lot of mediocre.
It's not Agents of Smash or anything.
No, it's not.
It's
not Spider-Man Unlimited. It's
right. I will say I definitely dislike it more than you did. You were kind of middle of the road on it. I'm far below middle of the road on it. I think it's a pretty weak effort. But, I mean, like you said, it's not so bad that I can just mock it at every turn. I can mock things about it. I can mock the weird noises that Stephen Strange makes in the movie. I can knock his incestuous relationship with his sister. I can knock the shoddy animation. But, I mean, it's not like perpetually, you know. If anything, it picks up as the movie goes on and becomes a passable animated movie. My problems are generally, for the most part, in the first half of the movie, I think. And then, of course, the ending, which, you know, is very convenient. I mean, Dormammu is the most easily defeatable threat I've ever seen in an animated movie. Like, he just literally, he appears on screen, does nothing, comes into the realm, throws like one energy blast at Doctor Strange, and then is beaten soundly and sent away.
Indeed. It is a very convenient final battle. Although I'll counter with, if you remember the first Ghost Rider movie, the main threat in that movie, Blackheart, was beaten with Ghost Rider just simply wrapping the chain around him and beating him in like 45 seconds.
Certainly a unique film series, that.
Yes, the Ghost Rider film series. And I'm kind of disappointed in myself that I remember it that well.
Yeah, because I didn't remember that. I still don't remember that, now that you've mentioned it. I've seen it. I just don't remember it. The only thing I remember about Ghost Rider, the movie, is feel like my skull's on fire.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. Well, Sam Elliott as well.
Oh, well, yeah, he was in it. I just like to imagine that Sam Elliott doesn't do bad movies.
Yeah, because they had the cool thing where he turned into a Ghost Rider too.
Mm-hmm. That was the best part of the movie, now that you mentioned it. I do remember that, yep. Never saw the second one, but...
No, nor did I. Apparently the second one involved him urinating fire.
And haven't we all been there?
Yeah. Have you ever been to Fire Island?
Yes, I have a summer home there. Why? Sanjay. What about Sanjay? All right, we're getting down the rabbit hole of TNA references. Let's wrap this baby up. This movie, ultimately, recommendation or no?
No, not really. I mean, if it were the only Doctor Strange thing out there, then maybe, but just to say, hey, there's a Doctor Strange thing that exists. But with the theatrical version coming out this week and Marvel's, you know, unbelievable track record at this point, I would just say go see the theatrical version. And I say that having not seen it yet. So
right.
I'm going to say no.
I'm going to say no, a hard no on this because it's to me it's really bad. But if you don't want to take the time to read a comic book about Doctor Strange before you see the movie, and if you don't want to go in completely cold to the movie, there are worse ways to get acclimated to the character than by watching this. It's not.
Yeah, but there are faster ways, like just reading Wikipedia too.
True. So, you know, I'm not going to recommend this. It's just not worth it. I mean, it's not the worst thing that I've seen, but it's just not good enough when compared to the competitors in the animated comic book film department. There are plenty of other better options to spend your time with. So ultimately, Doctor Strange, the animated film, hard pass. But the live action film, we're both pretty excited about, I think.
Absolutely.
And with that, we draw near to another close of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We've taken you off the page with a thoroughly uninteresting project in Doctor Strange, the Sorcerer Supreme. We will be back next week to give you, hopefully, if all goes well, our thoughts on the live-action Doctor Strange movie. Spoiler-free thoughts, I promise. And we will also be back with Russell Sellers of the Sellers Points making, I believe, his first appearance on Hard Traveling Fanboys. Is that correct?
He's been on some of the giant-sized editions, but
right.
First appearance on the weekly, the normal edition of the show, yes.
That's right, because we are coming back with the Hard Travelers for Hire, where we take a look movie by movie at the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We are going to the second entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, 2008's Incredible Hulk, starring Edward Norton. Looking forward to getting into that one, a somewhat forgotten film in the MCU. We're going to look at it. I haven't watched it in a long time, so I'm interested in rewatching it. And we'll be back with our thoughts on that along with Russell. And, you know, what do we have after that? We got the Longbook Hunters, correct, on the mm-hmm. the Punisher Welcome Back Frank by Garth Ennis and the late, great Steve Dillon.
Yep.
Got to look at that. We've got a countdown with Ben Morris joining us to talk about the top five Marvel video games. We have already recorded this one, and it was a lot of fun. We think it's one of our best episodes.
Absolutely. Very much looking forward to people getting to hear that. And, you know, as I've said before, lots of great stuff coming up for you here in the month of November. But in the first week of December, we have something very special that I know Greg is especially excited about. Greg, tell the people.
In early December, we are going to be joined by a special guest to look at a project that is an adaptation, a live-action adaptation.
To this point, we have revealed that it is a YouTube fan film adaptation of a Vertigo property.
And we will reveal here this week another bit of information that it is a YouTube fan film adaptation of a famous Vertigo DC property that has been made into a feature-length film.
Indeed.
So, and also, by the way, folks, this is going to be the
largest podcast ever.
At Place to Be Nation Pop. We're really excited about it. I mean, I don't know that Nick and I have been this excited for anything that we've done in life.
In life, yeah. No, I would agree. This is probably our crowning achievement in all our years of existence. And I would like to take a moment here to say that if you're ever an executive for Podcast One, I would like to remind you that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery and not at all copyright infringement.
That's right. I would point out that it's the
largest podcast ever.
At Place to Be Nation Pop, and not right. the
biggest podcast ever.
In general.
Right.
So it will indeed...
two different podcasts.
Two different podcasts, exactly.
Biggest podcast ever.
Is what my father did. We're in the
largest podcast ever.
In Place to Be Nation Pop business. So we're super pumped for that, in all seriousness, folks. This is probably going to change our lives because we're going to move on to the big time after this. Yeah. I feel like we're going to we're going to be making the big dollars coming out of mm-hmm. this, and you'll never hear from us again. You'll never see us again. We'll be retiring off of our
largest podcast ever
in Place to Be Nation Pop money.
Absolutely. It truly will be a record setter. So looking forward to that coming up in the month of December. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this Doctor Strange animated movie or any of our topics from the rundown earlier in the show, or our top three or bottom one books of the week, or any of the shows we watch on a weekly basis, be sure to hit us up with some feedback on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. On Twitter, I am at NickDuke87. He is at GPhillips8652. We also have email addresses, apparently, that are still open and available that can accept email. Nick D and Greg P, respectively, at placetobenation.com. So, myriad number of ways to get in touch with us if you feel inclined to do so. And as Greg says each and every week, we have shown that we will listen to feedback if you give it to us, unless it's feedback that Greg doesn't want to listen to. So, there you go.
Oh, listen at him. No. Let's open up. You're not going to leave the people with that. We're gonna be transparent here. I believe in transparency on the Hard Childhood Families. I have had it suggested to us by a listener. I've had it suggested to me by a listener that Nick and I should get into the full length commentary business of some of these off the page features.
Yeah, that basically if we're doing Off the Page or Hard Travelers for Hire, we would watch the entire film on the show.
Right, and his premise was that it would be entertaining. He enjoys listening to our commentary, and we have been hesitant to do that because our stance has always been we don't know enough about these projects the way that directors or even professional film critics do to comment on them, and his point was, well, it doesn't really matter as long as it's entertaining. So, that's a thought. The problem with that is the time investment. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about possibly doing Incredible Hulk, probably not going to do that because it's a significant time investment. As you heard tonight, we take a long time with our reading and watching right now when the shows are in season, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to talk about on that. Plus we do the rundown, so I feel like if we did a full-length commentary track, it would have to almost be its own thing. But we'll work the details out on that, and we'll figure it out and come back to it at a later time. But we really do want your feedback. We hope you're enjoying the show. If you're interested in any topics for us to address, send them in, and we'll add them to our extensive plans. We've got the show mapped out for a long time, but we're always willing to shift things around if something interesting pops up. So if you have any cool ideas out there, let us know. Send them our way, and we'll give them an old look-see. And with that being said, folks, thanks for joining us. Go out there and see Doctor Strange this weekend. Let us know what you thought about the live-action movie. Avoid the animated movie at all costs.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong. Was I unwise to leave them open for so long? I have wandered through this world, and as each moment has unfurled, I've been waiting to awaken from these dreams. People go just where they will,
I never noticed them until I got this feeling that it's later than it seems. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what you see. I hear their cries. Just say if it's too late for me. To cry.